Well, it certainly is a pleasure meeting you, because I really enjoyed the book very, very much.
Oh, thank you.
And I can't believe that this was a first novel?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I've written short stories for a while, but and novels that didn't do it, I mean, that I didn't send in, because they didn't, I didn't feel they were, you know, they were evolving into this one.
Uh-huh. Well, before we talk about The Beans of Egypt, Maine, which is now, of course, a paperback, let's talk a little bit about you, because you are a product of the state of Maine, and obviously there must be some parallels between your childhood and your existence and the Bean family. So tell me a little bit about yourself as you grew up. Where did you grow up in Maine?
Well, I grew up in one of the richest towns in the state of Maine, and I led a very comfortable life as a child, and I got poor later, and this is why I know there's a difference. And then, of course, since then, I've gotten some money, too, from my book, so I know that rich is better, or even $200 a week is better than minimum wage or less.
Did you grow up in a family much like the ones across the road from the Beans?
No. I don't think my parents would talk down people because they had some stuff around the yard. You know, they weren't like that.
Everybody has something around the yard in Maine.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's a few that don't, and they talk about it.
No, it's like Oklahoma. You always see a refrigerator out in the yard or a junk car or something. It seems to be a way of life.
Well, I'll tell you why. When you don't have a lot of money, you don't like waste, and you can use those things. Now, for instance, we had a washing machine in our yard that people complained about for a long time, and my husband now has made it the floor of our pickup truck. When it rusted out, he welded it into the floor, and now it's the floor of the pickup. And we had old skids, you know, those wooden skids from fork trucks. And the neighbors complained about that, and then we used it for the floor in our woodshed, you know, so.
Now, what part of Maine do you live in?
We live in Western Maine, Southern Western.
Now, what is that area like? All of Maine, I see all of Maine as being pretty rural, except for some, like Portland, but most of Maine seems to me, in my mind, rural. Tell me about what that area is like.
It's very mountainous. Where we are now used to be more like rural, more farms, but it grew up. The paper companies bought a lot of land, and other people too have bought chunks and then just allowed it to grow back into trees. So you have the old stone walls, and people there now who still remember the way it was. It's really weird. I mean, I have an aunt-in-law who can remember what was a pasture is now really huge trees, and she can remember it, you know, when those trees weren't there.
Did you grow up in this area as well?
I grew up a few miles away from there. This is my husband's hometown that I'm talking about now.
Yeah. Well, now your family, was it a literary family as you grew up?
No.
Did you have books in the house?
No, not really. Well, my mother had a few, but we never really read them. I think probably because I'm, myself, I'm too restless to sit long with a book. I like to move around a lot and do things that, busy things, you know.
If you're restless and don't want to sit around reading a book, I mean, how can you apply yourself to sit down and write a novel?
Because when I'm working, I'm not in the chair any longer. I am in the world of the book. I leave my body and go into this world where I move around a lot. You know, so it's not the same. It's like going to sleep and dreaming.
Education, tell me about that.
Education was terrible because I went to public school. And I feel that all public school is a disgrace. I was in a class of 20, and I was very shy, and I sat there for 12 years being an outsider.
Why?
Because I didn't participate. I was shy. Me, among others, there were several, I'm sure, you know, it was five or six who were in people, but the rest of us were outsiders.
What happened after graduation?
Well, first of all, I quit when I was 16, which was the best move I ever made.
So you quit school?
I quit at 16, and I went home and wrote like crazy. I wrote novels and short stories and did what I really want. I used to, when I was going to school, get up at 5 in the morning so I could write before I went and sat all day putting in my my, you know, serving my time. But after I got out, I could do it all the time. I was really happy. Then as time went on, a fella who was a neighbor of my mother's said that they were teaching creative writing at the high school and that I should try to do that. I might get a better attitude about school, too, because they treat you nice in night school. And it was true. I did. I loved it. And they treated us like human beings, and it was a small group. And I was finally good at something, because in school they didn't do any creative writing. They didn't do creative anything. And so, and then a little more time went by, and I thought I'd go to college. And I went for a couple of years. I had planned to major in psychology, but I had to quit before I could actually declare my major, because I couldn't afford to, you know, keep going.
Where did you go?
At University of Maine.
Home of the Stein Song.
Pardon me?
The Stein Song. Isn't that the University of Maine's
official
song?
Yep, yep. Yeah, it is.
Well, you said that in high school you were writing. You wrote in the morning and you wrote when you got home. What do you suppose led to this feeling that you had to write? You did not have a bookish family?
No. Control. I think I really like... Well, I also have a lot of... I have imagination, you know, like... I don't like repetition, and I like to kind of pretend things. As a little kid, I was a big pretender. And I think it was for control of the writing. And also, I played with little plastic horses and dolls. And I used to play... Like my brother and his friends. In my neighborhood, it was mostly boys. So if I had wanted to play with the kids, it had to be these boys. So we would play hunters and deer. I was the deer. And the neat thing was, see, I could have control. See, they could shoot and shoot and shoot, and I would never drop. See, so, I mean, there was always a lot of this pretending. And you could always take a lot of control when you invent your own world, which you don't get in the real world, of course, unless you're more outgoing.
Control and the fact that you were inherently a very shy person at that time, and you found a way to express yourself creatively that you couldn't do otherwise.
Right, and not anybody was giving, you know, looking at the work. Like you were saying, you know, my folks weren't readers, so they didn't really look at the work. And not only that, but it was like, I wouldn't share it anyway. It was my own private work. I didn't even ask them to look at it. It wasn't like I said, Ma, Dad, look at this, and they said, go away, I don't have time. They would have loved to have, but I just didn't. It wasn't anything I thought anybody would be interested in.
What were some of the things you were writing about during that time?
Well, one of the things that upset me a great deal when I got to be a certain age was to find out that my folks had lied to me. They had told me that hamburgers and hot dogs were made out of cattle and pigs that had died of old age. And when I found out this wasn't true, I was very upset, and I wrote stories or pretended with my little animals or myself that... you know, playing with the kids or whatever, that these animals would escape. I would cut the wire and let them out. We'd go on adventures together. Then later, when I was a teenager, being very shy, I'd go to the dances and stand off to one side. I was even better looking then, but I still was too shy to ever even, you know, look like I wanted to dance. I probably looked like I didn't want to be there. And so I would write stories about a girl just my size and description who would... boys by the thousands would be fighting over to dance with her.
Prior to the publication of The Beans of Egypt, Maine, you had been writing stories. Did you have any of these published?
Oh, yes, some short stories. But not for long, just for a couple of years before.
Mm-hmm.
I would never send them in. They really were just for me. I mean, I might have thought it would be nice if someone would read them, but I didn't really know what to do.
But while you were doing this writing, you were doing other things. You had not told yourself, I'm going to make a career of being a writer.
I think one of the reasons is the people who I admire were fellas who were farmers or carpenters and women who were housewives, excuse me. And I really admired them as kids. Those are the people that I knew to admire. I didn't admire writers. I didn't aspire to be a writer. I didn't, if a book was laying there, it wasn't something that was produced by human beings. As far as I was concerned, monsters made books because it had something to do with school, you know, so I just didn't, you know, aspire to that. But I did, the process of writing was very important to me in pretending.
Well, what were you doing in the real world during this process of writing?
Oh, during the novel? Well, a lot of the time I was home with my daughter during my first marriage, and then after that, I worked at a chicken factory, and I worked picking potatoes, and I worked as a correspondent for my town for a newspaper, but I was too shy to ask questions, so that didn't work out. And then I let's see what else. Oh, I worked as a homemaker. Those people that wear pink smocks and they go around and help old folks and poor people or sick people or whatever with their families.
Well, these were blue-collar jobs, which probably helped you a lot in learning about that sort of person and the sort of people who populate your book. So that was probably very valuable ammunition for you, don't you think?
Yes, not to mention that both of my husbands are blue-collar people. And my father was blue-collar. He's sold electrical parts, electrical wiring and stuff like that. And he wore sometimes a white collar in his job, but he was, as far as I was concerned, working class. I mean, to me, middle class is professionals, people who are professionals, you know, like doctors, lawyers, or whatever, and anybody else is working class. So, and then my husband, my present husband's family all work in the woods, and they were farmers. And my husband has a fireway business now and has always been blue collar.
Now, as you began writing The Beans of Egypt, Maine, did you plan this as a novel from its inception, or did you draw on these short stories and this sort of evolved?
I wrote a story that came out to handwritten 200 pages on yellow legal paper, some white too, because I used scrap, whatever I could find, and I then typed it over. And as I was going along, I decided I'd use pieces for short stories. I thought it was falling apart on me a couple of times, like it was going to just become a few short stories and I'd have to throw the rest of it. See, in fact, I had boxes and boxes of material that I worked on over the years. That took about 15 years to write that book. So I had boxes and boxes of material, and some of that material is what I'm using now in the novel now. So it's really hard to say which one, you know what I mean? There's sort of like... These were formations out of the material that I've been working on over the years.
The characters in the book, they came out of your personal experience. The Beans, there had to be a family like the Beans in Egypt, Maine, right?
Well, as a psychology major, I was interested in types of people, how they would react in different situations. Like I use it when it was real patient and when... I mean, not just a psychology major, but a person was attracted to that kind of thing. I always watch people. And then from my own experience, from being very, very poor, we were cold, we were hungry. I feel my baby died because I couldn't get in the hospital, you know, and I was in a very crowded clinic. And I was in labor for 2 weeks, a very painful labor, and he finally starved and was dehydrated. So I had a lot of the emotions of poverty, and I could put that into other events and other people and make those things work as fiction.
Of course, not all of the people are attractive. I mean, you describe eating habits, for example, which are, I guess, the passages you don't want to eat while you're actually eating yourself. You don't want to read while you're actually eating yourself. So I think there's a real true-to-life feeling in the Beans. Did you complete the novel and then submit it to an editor, or did you work closely with an editor? How did the book come about as a finished product?
Okay, a friend of mine had an agent who said she wanted to see the book, and we mailed it off to her.
This was a finished manuscript.
Finished. I don't think you could really tell the difference too much between the two unless you studied it, because the editor I had was. He was the world's best. He's still alive. As I worked with him, I'm thinking. He was left-handed and I was right-handed, and we sat there working on this book as if we were one person. Everything that he said sounded like my editor's side of my brain. I mean, it was, we never had any fights over it. It was as much fun working with him as it was writing the book. I was astonished because everyone told me, your editor is your enemy. I mean, well, the publishers are your enemy, they said so.
No, the editor is your friend, the publisher is the enemy.
Yeah, right, right. Well, as it turned out, the publishers were my friends, too.
Well, I would say so, because here is a person who's not known, a first novel, and so every publisher takes a chance.
That's right.
In doing something like that. So, but they obviously saw that there was worth in this book. Did the editor make major structural changes, or was the book left pretty well intact by the time it reached publication?
Like I say, if you studied it, you could see things in it, but nothing majorly structural, no.
Well, the book came out with last year, or was it year before last? Was it last year? When it first came out, it's a hardcover, last year.
It came out the December or November before that year.
It's copyright 85.
85. It was 84 in the fall that it came out in Maine because they wanted it to be there for Christmas.
Okay. Now, when the book came out, I remember reading the reviews. I read the book when it first came out myself, and the reviews were very respectful. You must have been very pleased.
I was very upset.
You were upset?
I was upset because they called people dirty and crawling out from rocks, and they made up incest between my father and my daughter character, and they even said that one of my other characters who was, I don't know how they had him being father to someone. I don't know. They made up all kinds of stuff. Maybe they didn't read it real good. I don't know, but I was really upset because I love these people, and I hated to see them being called scummy and all that stuff. They weren't dirty. They sweat when they work, and they don't throw out. If they get a little stain on something, they put it in the washing machine. They don't throw it in the trash. They can't afford to buy another one. They had stuff around the yard, but that's not felt.
Well, the book went through many printings, and it must have changed your life in some way. How was your life affected by the publication of this book?
Oh, wow. Great. It's been good. We've become new people. We aren't withdrawn anymore. We can get birthday presents for our friends and our family now. If something comes up in the family, we can drive there. We have the gas. We never had gas to go anywhere. My husband didn't have gas to get to work. His job that he had didn't have enough. It didn't pay enough to even get there. One of the jobs he had, the one he had the longest. And we've got the money now to get the equipment for him to have his wood splitting business so he doesn't have to work for someone else because he's got dyslexia and he's got very low self-esteem because the teachers used to do very cruel, disgraceful things to him. And then, of course, the kids did, too. If the teachers say it's okay, then the kids do. Said he was a bad person and all that. So, you know, now he can work for himself. He feels wonderful. All the other people in my family who have needed things, I've been able to help them instead of standing by helpless. My daughter, who was treated creepy by landlords, has now got her own house. And we're happy, except... what about the other millions who are out there? And so I feel like I can't really feel really happy until the other millions have some dignity in their own home and or at least a place that they don't get, you know, thrown out of all the time and some food and some heat. And
you can't do anything about that. I mean, the best thing you can do is to provide for yourself. One person, two people can't.
You can show
the concern, but there's no way to... spread the wealth around, I don't think.
Well, I've spread some of it around, and I also would be the first one to vote to spread it around a little better if there was such an opportunity to write letters or shoot my mouth off or something like that.
Did I read someplace that you didn't even have a telephone?
No, we still don't. Well, we do, but we never did, no. But now we do, but I don't plug it in because I was getting too many calls. But no, we don't. We don't have running water now. We don't have running water. We don't have plumbing. Or any of those things, because those are luxuries. And when I had to make decisions about my money, it was either help the other people in my family or to get a luxury for myself. It seems silly to, you know, there's certain priorities, shelter, food, medical, things like that come first before water that comes out of the tap. And those things are luxuries.
I don't see where you consider plumbing a luxury. I think that's basic, don't you, really?
Well, a city person would have trouble going in the alley, but we have the trees. We go out and we have a little outhouse out there, and we lug the water. We take the truck up to the spring and we fill it up. And it's very time-consuming, and it's a headache. But it was either that or my daughter would be still being chased around by landlords, so, you know, or my mother with her medical problem or, you know, this or that. And we wanted to get the equipment for my husband to have his own business so he could be proud to. I mean, dignity has something to do with all of this. You know, so.
Well, you're certainly an unusual, very candid woman. What is it like for you to be doing this traveling? What's it like if someone from the rural area of Maine plumped down in New York all of a sudden? What's that feeling like?
If there's a lot of people in the room, I feel dizzy. So all the vibrations, but 2 or 3 is good. And it's been, the only thing about it that's been bad is that I've not been working on my other book. I did go away for 2 months last winter to the McDowell Colony to work, which I probably will never do again because I was so homesick, but that was for 2 whole months.
Where is that?
It's in New Hampshire. And it's a wonderful place, and you can get a lot of work done. It gives you solitude, and yet you have people you can see in the evening so you don't go bananas. But I got really homesick, and I can work at home now because I've got a room. I can work in the attic. And,
Do you have a culture shock when you go into a big city like New York or Boston?
For those people who believe in astrology or are just are interested in it, Geminis like the two sides. I like both as long as I have both. I wouldn't want to be just stuck home all the time and never go anywhere, but I wouldn't want to be just going all the time and never get to be home and, you know, live that life.
What kind of schedule do you set up for yourself as you write your second book?
We do the housework and lug the water and do all that stuff through the morning, and usually by now my schedule seems to be by 9, I go upstairs and I just write. I don't write the hours. I used to work about 10 or 11 hours up there. Now it's maybe like 8 up in my room.
Still writing on the long pads?
Nope. Since I got the room, I have a place to set the typewriter up. So I had the typewriter before. It belonged to the newspaper people. I stole it from them. What happened was they gave it to me to work with, to do the newspaper work. And then they converted over to the scanner machines, and they never asked for it back, so I just kept it.
Shouldn't have said that on the microphone now. Somebody may hear it up there.
I don't think they would want it back.
How are the new novel that you're working on, is that going to be a sequel or something entirely different?
It's another love story about working class people in the mountains. And I don't really know what else to say about it, you know, in a short time.
Any of the beans going to be making an appearance, a reappearance?
Well, if they do, it's going to be very, they're just walking through or something, mm-hmm. because I don't like to use, I'd like to do new people. I don't want to just sort of, it's sort of tacky too, to kind of, you know, like, you know, those movies that have da-da-da-2 and da-da-da-3, you know.
Well, there's a Ernest Hebert.
Oh, yeah.
Who publishes for Viking, has written a wonderful, it's a trilogy now. I think he has finished a fourth in the series. I can't remember the family's name. Should have.
The Jordans.
Is it the Jordans?
Jordan.
Ollie Jordan, I think. Yeah, you have read the Dogs of March, and I can't remember the titles, but I've read all of the 3 books, and I've had him in, too. It's reminiscent in many respects, because he also has, I think his takes place in New Hampshire.
Yes.
But they're the same rural working-class people. But he has, his books have all featured the same characters going on and on.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Well, you're right. He did it. I haven't read the other ones yet. I met him at McDowell. Oh. He lives right near McDowell, and I met him, and I read the book while I was at McDowell, and I haven't read the others. But, yeah, I guess you could. Well, you could, but you wouldn't. No, he does. I guess he does focus right on their lives. I was thinking he might have them like a cousins or something.
Yeah, he does. He has a lot of subsidiary people.
Well, so actually it isn't the same mother, father, kid.
Yeah, all of the characters, at least from the first book, make a walk-on.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily focus on the same character,
yeah.
but they're there. The family's there. There are cousins and visitors and so forth. The local newspaper reporter makes an appearance in each of the book and the sort of thing. It's been a while since I've read them. He did turn in last year the 4th in this series.
He's got another one ready now that's... Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's his 5th.
Carolyn Shute, you've written a remarkable first novel, and I congratulate you for that, and you've given us something to look forward to. I'll be anxiously awaiting book number 2, and I thank you very much for taking the time to come in and talk to me about the Warner Books paperback edition. Thank you very much.
Thank you.